Today at Reader's Corner, John Dvorak, author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. With the 2017 total solar eclipse less than 2 weeks away, excitement is reaching a fever pitch in Idaho and other places across the country where this stunning celestial event will be visible. Today we view eclipses with wonder and anticipation, but that hasn't always been the case. In ancient times, eclipses were greeted with dread and fear and blamed for deaths, disease, outbreaks, and disasters. As scientific understanding of eclipses grew, so did interest in experiencing them, with so-called eclipse chasers traveling the globe to witness the next spectacular event. Eclipses have spawned myths that are still with us, even as their mystery continues to recede in the bright light of research and discovery. Today's guest, John Dvorak, offers a timely and fascinating look at eclipses in his new book, Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. Dr. Dvorak originally trained as a lunar scientist and spent 20 years operating a large telescope at Mauna Kea for the Institute for Astronomy at the University of Hawaii. He has published dozens of papers in scientific journals and has written for several national magazines, including cover stories for Scientific American, Astronomy, and Physics Today. His previous books include The Last Volcano and Earthquake Storms. Dr. Dvorak joins us today by Skype for this interview. John Dvorak, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, John, I mentioned those folks who are heading this way, the eclipse chasers. You may not qualify as an eclipse chaser, given your incredible scientific background, but you are coming into Idaho to take a look at this eclipse. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. I'll watch it either in Eastern Oregon or in Idaho, because that's the best place to go to be insured of a cloud-free sky.
Now, I'm sure you're aware from recent news that we've had some wildfires create lots of smoke in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, to name just three states that I know are affected. And I wonder if you have any thoughts or any evidence on whether or not that's going to really goof things up for folks that are planning on heading for one destination when, in fact, they might have to do a detour and go someplace else.
Well, that's right. That's probably one of the big unknowns, the possibility of brush fires and forest fires, and they will not only put smoke in the air, but they could also close some of the highways. And so if you have planned to go one way, you might be diverted and have to travel another direction.
Well, we hope that's not going to be the case. We're hearing all kinds of estimates of how many people are heading for Idaho, from 250,000 to 1 million, depending on who you're listening to. So clearly you're going to be joined by many other folks who are on their way. Why don't we start with a little bit using your academic background, if we could. Let's do some solar eclipse 101. What is a solar eclipse? How many of them are? How often do they occur? Give us a little background here.
Okay, an eclipse happens when the moon, the earth, and the sun line up precisely in the sky. And the solar eclipse is when the moon goes precisely between the sun and the earth. Now, a solar eclipse, a total solar eclipse, happens about every 18 months. That is, the moon's shadow touches the earth's surface about every 18 months. But because 3/4 of the earth is covered by water, and about half of the land portion is either a desert or a tundra, very seldom does the path of the moon's shadow pass over an area which has a lot of cities and towns and roads. And that's one of the things that makes this eclipse so exciting.
And what's so exciting about the year 2024? Is that there's something in your book, I believe, about the next great moment?
Well, that's right. The last total solar eclipse to be visible from the 48 states was in 1979. And so we had 38 years of an eclipse drought. But beginning this year, in the next 38 years, we'll have 4 total solar eclipses. One, of course, in 2017, and then the next one will be in 2024.
So with our solar eclipse glasses on, what are we going to see at the very beginning of this solar eclipse? How's this going to look to us?
Well, everybody in North America and the northern part of South America is going to see at least a partial solar eclipse. And it's during the partial phase. That's when the moon has not completely covered the sun. That's when you need these special glasses. And what you'll see is the moon, the silhouette of the moon, slowly move in front of the sun. So as time progresses, more and more of the disk of the sun is going to get covered, and the sun is going to look like a crescent.
And what's the bright halo of the corona?
Well, in order to see the corona, you have to be in the path of totality, and that is very thin. It stretches all the way across the country from Oregon to South Carolina, but it's only about 65 miles wide. You have to be in that narrow path to see it. And one of the fantastic things, and there are many, which you see during a total solar eclipse, is the corona. The corona is the beginning of the solar wind. It's the particles that are being thrown off from the sun. It's a pearly white halo that surrounds the sun. It comes out both as sheets and as streamers.
And is that happening during totality or after?
It happens in the sky all the time, but we can only see it when the moon completely obscures the sun, because the sky will turn almost as dark as night. Stars will come out, and we'll be able to see the corona that surrounds the sun.
So when there is this total eclipse, and we're talking about now the moment of totality, what happens in the natural world? What happens in the animal kingdom?
Well, what happens to animals, it gets dark and the animals think it's night. And so if cows are out in the field, they turn around and they head back through the barn. Birds, which are flying around in the sunlight, is when it gets dark, they'll head back to their nests. And that's pretty much what happens with animals.
How about the investor animal, the Wall Street animal? I understand you address that in your book.
That's right. There's a very curious thing that happens with a solar eclipse. Regardless of how rational we might pride ourselves in being, people are superstitious, and that includes athletes and gamblers and even stock traders. And because historically most cultures view eclipses as bad omens, stock traders in general will either hold off on buying something or will actually start a sell-off. And it's not a very large one, but over the course of time, if there's a total solar eclipse, the Dow Jones usually drops some 10 to 20 points. And then about 3-4 days later, maybe a week, it has this recovery.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with John Dvorak, author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with John Dvorak, author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. The August 21st eclipse, as you said, it's going to run through 12 states. There's something about Carbondale, Illinois, that seems to get the medal here. Help us understand that.
That's right. As the shadow of the moon goes across the Earth, the duration of the eclipse will change. And so the longest duration for this eclipse is in the southern part of Illinois, and it's about 2 minutes and 41 seconds. And what's remarkable is that the eclipse 7 years later, in 2024, that will travel from the state of Texas to Maine, and it will again cross through the southern part of Illinois. And so if you happen to be in Carbondale, Illinois, on August 21st, 2017, you will see a total solar eclipse. And if you stand there for 7 years, on April 8, 2024, remarkably, you'll see another total solar eclipse.
Very interesting. Well, obviously, your book is more than just about what happens on August 21st. You go back in history. And as I said in my intro, you point out that for much of history, eclipses have been viewed as harbingers of misfortune of one kind or another. Give us some examples of the misfortunes that have been tied to eclipses.
Okay, well, one of the famous ones is known as Black Monday in England. It happened in 1652, and this was still a time when people associated an eclipse with bad omens. And it's still known in England as Black Monday.
Well, what about, there have also been some problems as far as popes are concerned. 17th century Pope Urban, I think you pointed out, took some pretty desperate measures that really resulted from some prediction that came from astrologists, I guess, based on eclipses.
Well, that's right. Eclipses have had a historical impact. For example, in the Catholic Church, in the 17th century, Pope Urban VIII, there was a short series of lunar eclipse and a solar eclipse. And the cardinals who were against the Pope, and these cardinals were from Spain, predicted his imminent death. Now, the Pope knew that if he could perform magic, he would protect himself from this eclipse. And he had the magic performed, the eclipses occurred, and the Pope didn't die. And then as a result, he had the cardinals from Spain arrested, put in the Inquisition, and they mysteriously died of poisoning shortly after that. But most important for us, as a result of those predictions, Pope Urban VIII issued in 1632 a papal bull, and it stated that any member of the Catholic Church or any official could not engage in magic, sorcery, and astrology. And this was the schism that happened in the church between the period earlier when it did accept astrology and the period after. And this is still with us today. For example, Pope John Paul II in 1998, he was very concerned of a growing interest in sorcery and astrology. And he issued a pamphlet reminding all members and officials of the church that this had been enforced for the last few hundred years, and it all comes back to Pope Urban VIII and a solar eclipse in 1630.
And while we're on the subject of Christianity, how is identifying the actual date of the crucifixion of Christ tied to solar eclipses?
Well, the crucifixion is often associated with a total lunar eclipse. That's when the full moon moves into the shadow of the earth. And there has been a lot of discussion as to trying to get an actual date down. And for a very long time, it was thought that this was possible. And I don't have the exact date in front of me. But this is something that scholars have debated for well over 100 years. And It is one of those connections between what happens out in the sky, an eclipse, and an important event that happens here on Earth.
There are so many great examples in your book of how eclipses were used one way or the other to someone's advantage. Let's talk about the ancient Greek geographer Ptolemy and how he used it to map the Mediterranean. How's that work?
Oh, right. Ptolemy, he's back in the 2nd century A.D., he was interested in compiling the first map of the world. And as we know, it's pretty easy to figure out what the latitude is. If you look at the angle of the North Star above the horizon, that is your latitude. So if the North Star is directly overhead, you're standing at the North Pole. If it's down on the horizon, you're at the equator. The problem is longitude. And he had a novel way of doing it. He used a total lunar eclipse. The advantage of a lunar eclipse is that everybody in that hemisphere of the Earth will see the eclipse happen at the same time. So you can use this as a clock. And he used some old records of the timing of a total lunar eclipse to determine longitude of various cities in the Middle East. And he drew his map. The problem with his map is that he overestimated the distance of the longitudinal distance between these cities. And so his map of the Mediterranean is all stretched out east-west by about 600 miles. Now, this becomes important later, some 1,500 years later, when Columbus, if you recall back in 1492, Columbus wants to sail across the Atlantic, and he wants to reach China and Japan. Well, because of this error that Ptolemy made, Ptolemy thought the Mediterranean was much, much longer than it actually is, which gave Columbus the indication that China and Japan must be much closer to Spain than it actually is. And that's how some of these errors just continue to roll through history.
Now, you mentioned Columbus. Columbus used the eclipse in a slightly more crass fashion. Tell us about how he used it as extortion, you might say.
Well, you're right. It was extortion. The year is 1504. Columbus is on his fourth voyage to the New World, and he's in the Caribbean, and his ship is filled with worms. So he's having trouble trying to keep his ship afloat. So what he does is that he runs his ship up on a beach in Jamaica, and he tells the rest of his fleet to get help. Now, Columbus is on Jamaica for months, and the people of Jamaica are getting tired of this man who keeps ordering them around and giving them demands. And so Columbus, in order to ensure getting supplies, he comes out one night and he pronounces that if the local people won't give him supplies, he will make the full moon turn a dark red color. And that night there was a dark red color to the moon, a total lunar eclipse. And because of this extortion, he never had any problems getting supplies any longer.
He knew that was an accurate prediction, did he?
Yes, he did. He carried one of the first almanacs with him, and it happened to show a total lunar eclipse.
So Lawrence of Arabia, this list just keeps on getting more interesting. He used the eclipse to his military advantage.
Well, that's right. Lawrence of Arabia, he was fighting with the Arabs during the First World War, and they were against the Turks. And the Turks had control of a very important city in the Red Sea known as Aqaba. And the problem with trying to lay siege on Aqaba is that if you go by the sea, it has many of its guns pointed that direction. But if you go from the desert side, you'd be able to overrun the city easily. And so if you remember in that movie, Lawrence of Arabia, this long journey that's taken across the Sinai Desert, that's what Lawrence of Arabia did. What's not shown in the movie is that he knew there would be a total lunar eclipse. And so he held back about 10 miles from Aqaba. The Turks didn't know that he and the Arabs were there yet. And he waited for the total lunar eclipse to happen, knowing that the Turks would start making noise during the eclipse. And he took advantage of this, and he ran into the city. And because of all the mayhem, which was already going on, he quickly was able to take control of Aqaba.
Amazing. When we view history, as we're doing momentarily here, talking about eclipses, we often look to the west. Let's turn to the east, in what I guess is one of the oldest records of eclipses found in the Chinese. Tell us about that.
Well, the eclipses have had a very important impact on many cultures, and that includes in China. When we get to the 17th century, the Westerners, the Catholic Church, is trying to make inroads with missionaries and influence in China. In particular, they have sent off a small army of priests, of Jesuits. But the Jesuits are having trouble having any influence on the government of China or the emperor. Now, in China, as in many cultures, it's very important to get an accurate eclipse prediction. And the Chinese astronomers were having a lot of trouble with this. So the emperor of China had a contest. Who could actually predict the timing of the start of a solar eclipse? And he asked both the Chinese astronomers and the Jesuits to come up with a prediction. They did for a specific day. They came out in the courtyard in the Forbidden City. Hundreds of people were present. People were looking up at the sky. And the Chinese astronomers said that the moon's shadow would start moving across the solar disk at noon. And people waited, and noon came and passed. 1 o'clock came and passed, and still no solar eclipse. The Jesuits had made a prediction that it would start shortly after 2 o'clock that afternoon. 2 o'clock came, there was no silhouette, but by 2:10, they were able to see the silhouette of the moon start to move across the sun. And it's because of that, that the emperor, the Chinese emperor, embraced the missionaries. And for over 200 years, much of Chinese history would now be influenced by these foreigners.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is John Dvorak, author of Mask of the Sun. The book explores the science and history of eclipses. Well, let's go back to current day and what's going to happen here on August 21st and what's happened in recent years. The observations made by early astronomers point to the dangers of viewing eclipses without proper protection. What happened over the years? I mean, now we have Amazon sending out thousands of sunglasses to folks who want to order them, and you can pick them up in stores and wherever. Back in the day, there really wasn't anybody out there cluing in people on the damage factor.
Well, that's right. This is not during the time of total eclipse. This is during the partial phase, when you can still see part of the surface of the sun. The thing to keep in mind is that even if there's just a small ray of direct sunlight and it's not total, it is still very, very bright, and it can damage your eyes. The best way of getting around this is, of course, with the pinhole. That is, just put a little pinhole in a opaque sheet of cardboard or paper and project the image on the ground, and you'll see the crescent shape of the sun. Now, when I was young, a lot of people would use exposed film, sunglasses, and so forth. That's not very safe, because even though it will reduce the visible light, it does not protect you from infrared or UV light. And that's where you need these glasses. And they're widely available. In many places, they cost only a dollar or two, and there are places that are giving them out for free. And what these have is a plastic sheet, and it has a thin coating of metal. Mostly, it's I think aluminum oxide on it. And why you should use those is because it cuts down not only the visible light, but also the infrared and the ultraviolet.
You know, we're a university here at Boise State, and I see in your book that in 1684, the Harvard College president actually took some action that you might say legitimized eclipses. Tell us about what he decided to do there at the beginning of the term.
That's right. The president of Harvard in 1684, they were going to have commencement on July 2nd. And a few months before that, it was realized that there would be a total solar eclipse visible on that date. And so he went and petitioned the overseers of Harvard, could you please move commencement to July 1st? Because July 2nd, all the attention is going to be pointed up to the sky.
Well, you know, we are not dealing with a commencement. We're dealing with the first day of school. And we really thought long and hard about how we could do something that was different than just have students showing up at 8 o'clock in the morning for classes, and we didn't know what the Harvard College president did at the time we made this decision, but we're going to call off classes from 10 till 1 and have a party out on the quad and give students an opportunity to learn more about what's going on. And we'll have faculty out there explaining that, but we'll also, of course, have an opportunity for viewing and just a general opportunity for students to get more familiar with the eclipses.
Well, that's a good idea. Many communities along the eclipse path have already declared August 21st to be a one-time holiday, an eclipse holiday, and to close not only schools and government offices, but banks and stores. And it makes a lot of sense because the people who are working at stores would like to go out and see the eclipse, and people are not going to be shopping that day. People are going to be focusing their attention. There is this phenomenon, and it's you can see it growing right now, called eclipse mania. And it occurs days to weeks in advance of a total solar eclipse, when everybody's attention, every discussion, is about the coming eclipse and a preparation for it. And what are you going to see?
Sir Isaac Newton, he's best known for his theory of gravity, as we all know, which, according to legend, came to him when an apple landed on his head. How was his theory applied to predicting eclipses in a new way?
Well, in terms of eclipse prediction, the crucial person is Isaac Newton. Before Newton, and this is about 1700, before Newton and his theory of gravity, and he came up with the theory of the motion of the moon, all eclipse prediction was based empirically on watching cycles. And that's good, except after a while, you have to keep resetting all of your predictions. Isaac Newton came up with this theory of gravity at 1687, and in 1709, he actually brings out a theory of lunar motion. And so there's an actual explanation for the movement of the moon in the sky, and that greatly improved the ability to predict eclipses.
Now, I'm familiar with Halley's Comet. I did not understand that Edmund Halley, who the comet was named after, is a younger contemporary of Newton's, and he's really the guy, I guess, that had a lot to do with putting Newton's theory of gravity together with this prediction. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. Isaac Newton is a strange person in many aspects. One of them is that he would not socialize with other people very much. It took a great deal to come and talk to him and to get much of anything out of him. Now, Edmund Halley was much younger than Newton, and he's the one who went over and talked to Newton and got him to actually put out his theory of gravity. And as I mentioned, Newton comes up with the theory of lunar motion 1709, and Halley realizes there's a total solar eclipse going over in London in just 6 years. And so he applied Newton's theory to the motion of the sun and the moon, and he made what is regarded today as the first map of an eclipse path. And considering this was the first one, he wasn't too far off. He was only some 20 seconds off in terms of time, and only about 18 miles off in terms of the position of the lunar shadow. And it's from that work that our modern eclipse predictions come from.
Well, John, that's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for the interview, and thanks for the book. It's Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses by John Dvorak.
Thank you.
Next week, Beth Macy, author of Truvine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Samantha Wright. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.